Now to introduce to you a couple of guests that we have from our friends south of the border. We have two presentations from Minnesota and Iowa. So the first gentleman I'd like to call up to the podium is Mr. John Anderson, who is the president of the Minnesota Pork Producers Association. So please help me welcome John to the podium.
Thank you. I got to start by saying I'm a farmer. I'm not a public speaker, so this might not be as polished as the ones you heard earlier today. But we'll get through it, I guess. First, I'd like to extend greetings from Minnesota pork producers. We import a lot of your hogs, and we appreciate them. They're good quality, fast-growing, usually healthy pigs. A little bit about myself. I farm with my family in a small town of Belgrade, which is, if you're driving from Fargo to Minneapolis, about by St. Cloud or Sauk Center, we're 20 miles south, and that's the area that we farm in. We have 3,000 sows, farrow to finish. We're a daughter nucleus for DNA genetics. So we've actually brought pigs, gilts back up to Manitoba here a number of years ago. And in doing so, we got to realize what you all have to do with some of your regulators. We had to go through and bring up, we were bringing them up 600 at a time, going into an isolation barn, and this one load, there was a gilt on there that did not have the right tag. So we were informed we were taking all 600 of them back home again, and there was absolutely no discussion. So it sounded like I was in my own country again, but I guess regulations are there for a purpose. 2 days later, we loaded them up and brought them back, left that one pig at home, and everything was fine. But another reason that I am here and not Dave Price, our normal CEO, or is our CEO, I guess he's more than normal. We had the opportunity to, a lot of our officers for both Minnesota and Iowa are at Washington, D.C. this week, working on things, same things you guys are working on, labor issues, permitting and things like that. So I had the opportunity to go there or go to talk to pork producers in Manitoba. So I thought I got the better than the stick and was able to come up here. For years, I've been meeting George at our convention, and always invite him to stop in, and finally gave up, so I figured I'd come up and talk to you. And it's also kind of neat that my daughter, who's part of our farm, has a social media friend that's here also, Andrea, and so they're both working on promoting pork on both sides of the border. So let's see, that we have the next slide. There you go. So production update for the U.S., as many of you know, that we had a 2% inventory decrease for the U.S. Iowa lost 3%, and we lost 1% year over year. I think there's many reasons for that. The pandemic didn't help. Guys my age that decided they've had enough and not somebody coming behind in the wings. A lot of older buildings that just got decommissioned. As of March 30th, Iowa had 23 million hogs. We're the little brother to the north at 8.6 million hogs. And we import about a million pigs into Minnesota a year from Canada, and 90% of those come from Manitoba here. Labor is a big deal, both on our farms and the packing plants. We're working, that's one of the things that some of the state leaders are doing out in Washington, D.C. right now, trying to work with some politicians to increase some foreign labor, TN programs, and things like that. Another slide there. Proposition 12, I think Kevin is going to talk more on this. So I'll leave that one up to him. Next slide. Trade. U.S. imports a total of 4.5 million pigs, whether it be wean pigs, breeding stock, or market hogs from Canada. Say Minnesota gets about 1 million of those. 90% of them come from the U.S. or come from Manitoba. We ship a lot of pigs to Mexico. A lot of that has probably got to do with the labor shortage in the U.S. I ship a lot of fresh hams down there. They'll debone them and send them back. As you can tell on the graph, Canada adds about $7.38 to the dollar of our market hog. So as trade is very important to us as well as you, and you know, we're working on diversifying our trade portfolio all the time. And I think that's the last slide. Is that right? So I'll wait and then answer some questions after Kevin does his presentation.
Thank you, John. Yes, so next, Kevin Rasmussen from Iowa is going to do a presentation for us, and then we'll open the floor up for questions from our U.S. Counterparts.
So, first of all, thank you very, very much for the invitation. I appreciate it. And the state of Iowa appreciates Manitoba pork more than you realize. As you can see there, that's basically what a snapshot of what Iowa looks like. We import about 2 to 2.5 million pigs from Canada every year, most of those coming from the Manitoba region. And I will tell you personally that my best group that I've ever run through a finishing barn at 2.8% death loss came from Manitoba. So they are high-quality pigs, and we appreciate them, and we thank you very, very much, and keep up the good work. Next slide, please. Looks like we got part of it anyway. So, yeah, there's total pigs. Next slide. Breeding herd is just under a million sows. That's why we need your pigs. When you look at packer capacity and what we have and the capacity we have in the state of Iowa, we do not have enough sows in Iowa to feed the plants that we have currently in Iowa. Next slide. Yep, there you go. So next slide, please. Yeah, so we have 14 major packing plants. Currently, labor is our number one issue on the farm as well as in the plants. And the newest plant there, you'll see kind of the center dot there. I live about 12 miles from that plant. A little bit about myself. Grew up there in Humboldt County, right close to that middle red dot there. Went to college a little bit, came back. Started farrowing sows and A-frames in the field and built a sow unit in 1993. We just sold our sows in 2020. Didn't have a good succession plan. Buildings were getting old. Lisa and I said next time we have a major disease challenge that sows are going to go to town. And Lisa and I have said we won't say that the good Lord gave us PERS in 2020, but definitely gave us the knowledge to know that it was time to quit, and we sold our sows right before the pandemic, and so it's been a good choice for us. So we are currently contract growers. So we've run the gamut from outside pasture farrow to 1,000-head farrow to finish sow herd to the current situation we're in right now. Foreign animal disease is our number one concern in the state of Iowa, followed by labor and all of the same issues that you have here. You know, I said to Evan earlier that I don't view it as a U.S. pork production and Canadian pork production. I view it as North American pork production because we all share the same challenges and the same goals and the same aspirations. U.S. SHIP, so the United States Swine Health Improvement Plan, is one of our vehicles that we're using to be prepared for foreign animal diseases. Their pillars are biosecurity, traceability, and disease surveillance. So they're the three committees that make up U.S. SHIP are biosecurity, testing and sampling, and traceability. I was currently working on a proposal to bring to light or bring to realization with our leaders what kind of tonnage we're looking at in a depop disposal issue in the face of a foreign animal disease. We've dealt with avian bird influenza. Our leaders feel like they've got it figured out. You know, we've done this with birds. We surely ought to be able to do it with pigs, and we don't think that they understand the kind of tonnage and what it's going to cause or what we're going to have to deal with if we have to do a depop and disposal to eradicate a foreign animal disease. So we're going to take a 1,200 head sow farm farrow to finish, and with multiple sites, and kind of do a mock outbreak to show our leaders the kind of tonnage, the kind of land mass it's going to take. Our current DNR is not going to allow, where our water table is probably not going to allow for burial. So it'll all be above ground composting, and it's going to take a lot of carbon to accomplish that. So we need to get that in front of them. I think probably the key issue that I want to impress upon Manitoba pork, excuse me, is tell your story. Come up with your elevator speech. Do it often. I think Cam is exactly right. This industry is yours. It's yours to lose. The advocates that are out here trying to sabotage or put you down, they don't have excuse me, they don't have as much power as what they'd like to think they have. Thank you, Cam. Appreciate it. The power lies in your hands. So tell your story and do it. With that, I believe that's my last slide, isn't it? Oh, I have issues to consider here. Yep. And I think I've touched on most of those. I think John passed the buck on me. I was hoping he was going to talk about Proposition 12. So the only thing I'm going to say about Proposition 12 is I think all of you know that the Supreme Court voted to hear our case, the U.S. Supreme Court. So that's the highest court in our nation. And we'll see. The timeline on that is probably fall. They'll probably hear it sometime in October. So it'll be fall, late fall, before we'll know. Currently, the poultry industry deals with 26 different state ballot initiatives, and they deal with it. So we as a pork industry in North America are trying to tell the state of California they can't do it when 26 different states have been doing it for many years in the egg in an industry. So we have an uphill battle, but we'll see what happens. That's all I'm going to say about that, though. Do you have any comments, John, on Prop 12?
No. As I understand, Manitoba's working, or has worked with us on that same issue on a number of different fronts, so we appreciate that.
So I would open it up for discussion and questions. I'd really like to have some dialogue here if you like. Have some questions for us?
I've got a decently loud voice, so I'm going to give it a shot anyways. I just wanted to, could you let us know what Proposition 12 is and if it's stuck, what sort of impact that would have on Minnesota and Iowa?
Could you ballot initiative for California a number of years ago, where it set the it didn't really have rules when it was put into place, but it was billed as an animal welfare initiative at the time, getting rid of gestation stalls. And a lot of our industry, I think maybe up here too, have moved away from onto loose housing, but Proposition 12 went farther in there. Requiring, I believe, 24 square feet per sow, and then turnaround crates and farrowing in that too. Is it an effect on California consumes 13% of the U.S. pork, but they only produce, I think they have about 5,000 sows, so they're not producing very much. We were kind of slow in adapting, which it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because those of us who have worked in barns know it's just, it's one of those political things, I guess.
Jason?
I also talk loud. So if it happens, how are the consumers going to get their pork, their 13% pork?
Well, we got a little grace by, I think it was the grocers, and there were a couple groups in California that went and got a injunction against this to stop it until 6 months after the rules are written. But that's a good question.
So currently, California's restaurant and food service industry has sued the state of California because they're scared that they're not going to be able to get their product. They have no plan. They think that will change. The niche market producers in the U.S. are licking their chops because they think they can supply that, but there's no way. I mean, just do the math. There's no way they're that large, and that's not going to happen. It's going to be a challenge, and it's going to be a slow curve. So my daughter and future son-in-law live in Boston. He used to work in a grocery store, and their meat manager called it's been a year ago when he was visiting in Iowa, and he said, well, I'll ask the future Iowa pork producers president, he's standing right here, because they have what they call question three, which does the same thing. So our animal rights activists have hit up the key states that raise very, very few pigs and put these ballot initiatives in. John, are there three states, or there's more than
California or Colorado is going on the ballot too, I think.
Yeah, so there's three states that currently have ballot initiatives, but two of them have put theirs on hold until they see what happens with Proposition 12 in the state of California. So it's not just the 13% of pork that California consumes; it's going to be a bigger number than that. So it adds basically 30% to the cost of a new facility to make it Prop 12 compliant, even though we don't know what Prop 12 compliant is because they haven't written the rules yet.
If you're buying pigs from Manitoba, then you need to be...
I yelled at waiting for the mic, so I guess I should too. If you're buying pigs from Manitoba and you need to be compliant, what sort of certification are you? And then the mic dies. I know that this is a ways down the road, but I think we should talk about it. Is what kind of certification are you going to need from isoween suppliers here in Manitoba?
I imagine there's going to be an auditing process that we would have. You guys would have to be audited just like ours. And then certified in a paper trail following the pigs all the way through harvest. But then that's just me talking. There's no rules written.
Right. Yeah.
Question with regard to that acronym COOL has coming up in the beef industry in the States. You anticipate anything coming in the hog sector?
We haven't talked about it in our group.
I don't think pork producers are excited about country of origin labeling. I know the beef industry talks about it a lot. we were there once, and we took it away for a reason. And I think that hopefully we're smart enough to remember the way it was, and we don't go back there. We don't see a value in it. The consumer didn't see a value in it. Yeah, and back to my speech about tell your story. Lisa and I had the chance to travel around a bit, and so we tell our story quite often. And really the only key things that people really want to know, and we talk in Iowa, we talk about the movable metal, and so you don't want to talk necessarily convert the vegan, because he's happy with his lifestyle, and he's got reasons and motivations why he's doing what he's doing, and he's not the movable metal. What you want to talk to is the movable metal, and they want to know basically two things, in my opinion. They want to know that there's a human taking care of their pigs in a humane fashion. The pig that lived a very happy, healthy life, and that he's not been abused in any way. And the meat arrives at their table. They don't want to know the gory details in the middle. They just want to know the high level that there's a human. It's not the Chipotle ad that they see on TV that shows this robot raising pigs, chunking up little pigs, and they're going to the slaughter plant, especially the picture. They know that's not right, but they got to have a reason not to believe it. And so we need to tell our story.
Rick Bergman.
So we have a lot of common issues between our countries. We always have been and always have and no doubt will. On the topic of labor, and you had it up on your slide there, that's you've heard it here this morning as well. It's an issue that we're trying to understand as well or trying to fix. If you look at the next few years or the next 5 years in your country, in your states, have you thought of some solutions to the labor challenge right now that you feel would be beneficial to get either people or AI, like artificial intelligence, into the farms to help with the void of the labor issue?
I'll go first, Evan, and you can. You know, I think we're all pork producers and know that it takes a compassionate person take care of day one pig here. And I can't see where that ever is going to change. If our politicians would ever get their act together and make the road to citizenship from the southern border, I don't know if our labor issues would go away, but they would be a lot easier. We have Hispanic workers on our farm. Great people, they want to become citizens, or not necessarily citizens, but they want to live here and become part of the community. But every time you go to Washington, it's the same old dog pony show, you know. I think it's, you know, for a while there during COVID, it got easier. There were people that that got laid off, whatever, wanted to keep working, and we were able to find help, but most of them have stayed. But labor is an issue not only in pork producers, or all over, right? You go down the street, and there's a manufacturing place in our town that has posted, you know, starting wage $20 an hour. Well, that's where our starting wage had to go to. You know, it's, and we're all competing for help. I don't have an answer. I don't know.
No, I think John's exactly right. If we had an answer, we wouldn't be sitting in front of you guys talking to a bunch of pork producers. We'd be doing something else. It's not that simple. The fact is, we send hams. We all send hams to Mexico. Mexican labor in a processing facility to debone those hams and send them back up here. They pay those workers on average about $20 a day. We're paying $20 an hour for starting wage. I know Ron Prestige built a brand new plant. It's 12 miles from my house. He still hasn't been able to fully staff it. He started out at $12.50 an hour, and the sign just kept going up. Currently, it's plus 18, plus sign-on bonus and all these other warm, fuzzy things. Labor is definitely an issue. And the only way, in my mind, there's two ways to solve it. And One was with more people or more automation. And both of those cost lots of money.
Got a question here that came in on the hotline. Someone's wondering, what percentage of the U.S. industry is loose housing?
I don't, but it's getting more all the time. And there are barns being built, Prop 12 compliant. There's contractors, I know Tyson for sure, and I believe JBS also are giving bonuses for, and Lynch Livestock, giving bonuses for, or signing long-term contracts to help pay for the cost. You know, so even if the Supreme Court knocks us down, I think, like we talked about the eggs, it's going to be here. We're going to have to, you know, and that's okay as long as they don't mandate it, right? If I'm willing to pay extra for it, well, I'll build a barn. You know, but until that time comes, I can't see going backwards in production.
Any more questions for John or Kevin?
Yeah, it's interesting, like, through, like, you'd be probably aware of our Canadian Code of Practice and stuff. It's interesting through that we have, like, a standard for what group sow housing is, but it's not Prop 12 compliant, and, you know, it's interesting when someone can put that in. It's like we've kind of tried to define what group housing is, but then someone comes along and says, no, that's not group housing, this is group housing, and then you have to change your standard. It's
so is your difficult. Standard 18 feet square feet?
There actually isn't a minimum in our standard for square footage, but obviously there's, you know, 18 square feet is probably the minimum recommended we would have or whatever before you start seeing some bigger issues and stuff like that. So, but no, ours is more around they have to be in groups by 35 days after breeding, basically.
The thing we got to keep in mind here is with the final rules for Prop 12 haven't been written, so when you say we're building Prop 12 compliant barns, we hope we're building Prop 12 compliant barns. And if you look at the egg industry, those rules change continually. You know, so I currently have an egg facility that's right beside me. It's a cage-free egg facility, which is means the chickens get out of the cages and run around on the floor, and then they use lights to put the chickens back in the cages, and they shut the doors so that the chickens lay their eggs on the belts, and so they get processed that way. Well, that building got built. They had to go in and remove all the doors because the rules got changed. You can't lock them in the cage. But, so.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I'm not trying to hog the mic too much, but yeah, it's like almost like it's a bit of an It's a bit of an unsustainable model in a sense, right? Like, that's the tough part. And I'm like, I'm glad you guys take it to the Supreme Court because you almost need a precedent set that, like, okay, we built these facilities. They're supposed to be there for 30-plus years or something. And now you tell me, you know, 2 years later that it's not no longer compliant. Like, and that can happen all the time. But, I mean, that's such a bigger issue, right? I don't know.
Yeah, it's not the, it's the animal activists trying to get rid of animal agriculture. It's the bottom line.
Yeah, I hope there's no press in the room.
Ed, stop scribbling.
It's already happened.
I don't really care.
I'm just a big farmer. No, we feed the world, and we're proud of it, and we do a really, really, really good job of it, and that's everybody in North America that's involved in pig production. It doesn't take one individual or one commodity. We're one group of people to feed the world. It takes the whole village, and our village is very large, and we need to share that story about how many people we actually touch and employ in the North American pig industry, and we feed a lot of people. It's the number one protein source in the world, period.
Other questions?
I'd just like to switch a little bit to ASF planning, and so first off, thank you for coming. And I think one of the things that we need to do is I think our governments are actually doing a pretty good job of talking to each other about foreign animal disease. It's not just ASF; it's others as well. And you know, from from where I sit, I would like to do more of that with you as well, and so that we're coordinating, you know, communications plans and those kinds of things. But how much of your planning is focused on, you know, the farm that actually has been affected, and how much of your planning is focused on everybody else? Because everybody else is going to be impacted as well. And I'll preface that by saying, the majority of our planning is actually focused on everybody else.
Sure. I think we're both there. Minnesota and Iowa have a task force working for this outside of the SHIP program that Kevin mentioned. And it would be great if our states and Manitoba, where we get together, because of that common boundary is, you know, I'd say 90% of your pigs come down as isolines, I believe. Well, if we get ASF, that border can be shut off too. You know, so you have a lot of stake in it. So, what was your question again?
How much of their time is spent on folks?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So, on the task force that I'm part of, you know, our first line, and we're going to try to stamp it up, whatever we can take. To create a control zone and try to get rid of disease. And if that doesn't happen, which we always say that's not going to be an option, but it might, then we look to the broader picture. You know, I know they're working on oral fluids testing and surveillance. I mean, that'll be a big part of it, is to know where the positives are and try to sample them as fast as we can. I live in a part of the state where a lot of turkeys grow. And in 2015, it went through, there would be positive turkeys farm or turkey barns that were, all the turkeys would die of the disease before they came in and euthanized them. This time around, if they have a positive within 24 hours, those birds have been culled. You know, so we're learning from all these things, and even when COVID hit, how to depopulate large groups of numbers. I don't know if you guys had to depopulate much because you had no pecking place or no place to go with the animals. Unfortunately, we learned some lessons from that also. So we're getting closer to where we are, but like Kevin said, if ASF hit in St. Martin County, Minnesota, where you probably have, I don't even know the numbers, but you have a hog farm in a quarter section of land, and to draw a 5-mile circle there, you encompass a lot of pigs. It only gets worse if you get a dire one.
So my nightmare situation is somebody finds a dead wild boar along the road, and they test him, and he tests positive for foreign animal disease. So how do you draw a circle around that? Because we need to identify, we need to isolate, and eradicate. That's the point. And so you draw the circle around, but how do you draw a circle around a wild pig that you found dead along the side of the road? So then our production system, which we're very, very good at, continues to flow. We continue pumping pigs out. We in Iowa, or in the United States, we export 30% of our product goes export. You export 90%. Those things stop immediately. We got a problem. So the best thing we can do is do our biosecurity very, very, very well, communicate to our importers that import our product, that we know how to identify, isolate, and eradicate the disease in the timely fashion.
I do think that our governments, both yours and ours, I know ours for sure, are stepped up their game at the airports, trying to help us out. They know what it's all about, and they know the seriousness of it.
My question is related to, for ASF, if, you know, it happened, heaven above, who is responsible? Is it the state, or is it the federal government in the United States for eradicating the surplus healthy animals that you don't have a market for? who is responsible for all of those pigs
that
don't have a home?
As producers, we are. We get indemnity on sick animals only.
But there's no plans or programs?
You know, there's been talk about trying to get something in writing and that. And that raises a good point, because if I'm an independent or independent producer and you have all your life savings in this 1,000-head barn and the market tanks, you get rid of your pigs, well, maybe you get turned to ASF positive so you get rid of, get paid for it, right? I'm not saying anybody would do that, but it's a scenario that we've thought through. You know, so.
Well, that happened in the UK, right? People purposely infected their cattle so that they could get paid for foot and mouth disease. So
it's just, yeah. I mean,
so as a producer, if your barn was healthy, you're responsible for the depopulation of your herd for pigs that you don't have a market for.
I would rather say those decisions have not been made yet, rather than assume that the individual pork producer or the independent pork producer is going to be responsible. I would hope, and it's a hope, that there would be some sort of national action that would, so we stop that voluntary infection to be able to get paid, because that is not a good situation.
We have a question here.
Learn from the PED in the early days. This is just what talk is, but it possibly when it was founded, I believe it was Oklahoma, Utah, that they could have stopped it there if they would have got rid of those pigs at a time of fashion. I don't know if that'll happen here or not, but and the thing about PED is you that 6 to 12 hours of being exposed, you know you have it. With ASF, it could be 2-3 weeks.
Great.
Yeah, one more question rolled in here. Can you explain the U.S. SHIP program a little bit more?
U.S. SHIP is it's international.
It was patterned after the poultry industry. They've had it on for like 30 years. There is a house of delegates from many different states that come together and try to develop a plan if foreign animal disease shows up. And that's what we're working through now. I think our first meeting in Des Moines here last August, I believe, or September, or somewhere in there. And then we're meeting in Twin Cities here this fall.
So I'm not currently a representative or a member of that.
Okay, I am.
Okay, so John's probably, but their pillars are biosecurity, traceability, and disease surveillance. And their committees are biosecurity, sampling and testing, and traceability. And you can get on the website, it explains it pretty well. That's where I got this information, because I'm not currently part of that committee structure.
One other thing,
go ahead first.
One thing I just wanted to bring up during your presentations this morning, you mentioned antibiotic use. We've had to have a VLD or a veterinary feed directive for quite a few years, and it's a good thing. We just don't throw antibiotics at our pigs. Not that I'm saying everybody does, but it forces you to talk to a vet before you put it in your feed, and it also puts a little bit of the onus back on the vet. It's been working fine. You only need, I think, they expire every 6 months and if you have enough to feed them. That's for feed beds. Water beds, we don't need that.
So, in the VFDR, most of the paperwork lies on the feed mill and the paperwork at the mill.
My question goes back a bit to the compensation thing, because that's one of the things that we're really wrestling with here in preparing for foreign animal disease. We didn't really have the same scenario as parts of your sector did in the U.S. in terms of our processors having to close or reduce because of labor force out with COVID. But where that happened in the U.S., was there any compensation, or if it was, if I was a producer and my animals were due to go to the plant, but there was no place to put them, was that financial hit mine?
No. Well, yeah, a little bit. Less than no. Yes and no, I should say. There has been some bills going through that producers have been compensated for the expense they incurred while depopulation. You know, whether they're hauling to a rendering plant or composting and things like that. To the best of my knowledge, I don't think anybody's been reimbursed for the actual animals that they've had put down. Kevin, if you know.
No, to my knowledge, nobody got reimbursed for the value of the pig, just for the cost incurred of the disposal. So the highlight of that story of COVID is slowing pigs down. I remember calling so I currently feed for Dr. Baumgart, Dave Baumgart's RC Family Farms, and I called him and after we had an Iowa Pork Board meeting, and I said, hey, Dave, my pigs are weighing about 100 pounds right now. I said, can we slow these pigs down? Because I said, there's a train wreck coming up here. And he's like, we don't see it. Nope, not a problem. 3 weeks later, I get an email that says, new rations coming, turn the temperature up in the barn 2 degrees, and blah, 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 blah. We figured out really, really well how to slow pigs down. And that was the huge advantage that we found out in COVID. We can slow these pigs down. It's harder to speed them back up once you've slowed them down, but we've learned how to do that. So that's one thing. We can figure out how to identify, isolate, and eradicate fast enough. We can slow some pigs down, maybe not in an isolated situation. Mama does a really good job nursing pigs.
Yeah. We had a barnload of pigs that was ready to go. They were gilts. And I had started just with culling, whatever you want to call it. I did about 30 head, and I couldn't do it anymore. And the next day, I got a call from a farm that broke the furs looking for 1,000 gilts. And so I was able to have a market for them. You know, I didn't get much for them, but at least didn't have to euthanize them. But, I mean, it's a hard job to have to do. I know people that did have to euthanize pigs, and I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
What kind of impact do you think the 30 by 30 program is going to have on agriculture and on pig production? The program where they're trying to take land ownership away from independent producers?
I'm not familiar with 30 by 30.
Okay,
so
I guess.
Like a program you want to keep in Canada.
Okay.
You know, we have another thing we wrote down on our strategic plan that we did last year. We one of our pillars was social license to farm, which a lot had to do with what we heard about earlier. But we started a program to measure the amount of carbon that our farms put out. So we go to talk to environmentalists and that we have solid numbers that we can bring to them and say this is what we're actually doing. I don't know if you guys maybe are doing the same thing, but. It's a good program. I think we've had about 50 farms go through it, and you learn a lot about your farm.
Hey, maybe I have time for one more question. Mark?
Okay. Just along those lines, where do you think there's opportunity to improve on that side of things, like on the environmental side? We're kind of close to going through another round of like research funding and innovation and that side of things, and I'm wondering where we can improve.
I probably have to think about that a little bit, so I'd say to tell you the right thing. I mean, so a lot of it has to do with the grain production side.
So my pigs currently go into the Holstone system, and Holstone is currently keeping track of their carbon footprint, so like you have to keep track of water usage, kilowatts, propane. They keep track of the feed and the trips, so the feed truck. So, I mean, just little things about maximizing tonnage on feed trucks. So the fewer trips for the feed truck. So the land mass that produces the corn, you know, if you're using all those sustainable practices that are really, to be honest with you, they enhance your production practices in the cropping. Those all affect your carbon footprint. But the fastest way to affect your carbon footprint is on efficiencies, so the throughput. So, you know, if you're producing 26 pigs per sow per year and you're an ISO breed wean, you know, if you're a breed to ISO wean, and you bump that to 32, man, you just hugely, hugely affected your carbon footprint. So that's efficiencies, in my opinion, are the fastest way to improve your carbon footprint. Fewer days, faster growth, daily gains, lower feed efficiencies, lower depth loss, all those things that we try to do every day.
Okay, great. Well, I'd like to get you to help me thank Kevin and John for their very informative presentations.